actually have a thing that you snap.
Right, yes, the, like the movies.
Okay, it's July 13th. This is Ken Kellerman. We're here with Ellen Boughton and Dave Hogg to continue our discussions with Dave Heeshan. So there are a few things to follow up from last time. We just talked in the car. Dave confirmed it was S. Fred Singer. Want to put the veil in the Everglades. Dave, we were talking last time about the 600 foot, the Sugar Grove, 600 foot, and I'm still confused about what, if any, relationship there was between that and the proposed NRAO very large telescope. Was the Sugar Grove project classified? Did everybody know about it? In the late 50s?
I don't think the project was classified. Maybe the purpose of it might have been classified.
Yeah. And the actual details. But it was not, it was all known about.
Well, sure. Yeah. That great big thing sitting there in West Virginia, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have a whole lot of contact with him, as I recall.
But except maybe through Hagen.
Through what?
John Hagen, who certainly must have been plugged into
it. Yeah, sure. But even so, we didn't have, at that point, we didn't have a whole lot of contact with Hagen either. We had more with Ed McLean and Connie Mayer.
I'm talking about the years, there are all those committee meetings.
Oh.
Because even then, he was pushing for the 600-foot telescope.
Was he?
Apparently.
Could be. I was not in the loop at that point. I was either a graduate student or just a postdoc.
But you were going to the AUI.
I was going to AUI meetings. I was sort of a gopher for them.
Okay, well, I guess we'll have to be sure to go as a mystery.
Yeah, I don't know about it.
The 140 foot. You mentioned last time that the construction started before the design was complete.
Yeah.
And especially the work on the foundation before we knew what the foundation had to support.
Well, did I say that?
Not those words, but you did say the construction started before the design was complete.
I'm sure of that, but the foundation part I didn't know about.
I think it
makes sense, but I don't.
I think you said foundation.
Okay.
I added the extra words about adding that.
All right.
But did the same thing happen with the GBT?
The same thing being?
Construction started
before the design was completed.
Especially on the foundation. And then the foundation turned out not to be adequate. I'm looking at Dave Hogg.
Yeah. The foundation was thought to have been a problem as the weight went up.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But the tests, as long as it was built to spec, the tests said it would be okay. I don't recall if they had to put extra stuff in as the weight went up.
So there was no change in the design?
Not that I remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either. I was a kibitzer at that point.
I remember that.
There was a great
concern.
And had the weight gone up any significant amount above what it ended at, then there would have been a foundation.
I remember something about the paint. The paint alone.
Significant, but that wasn't the driver, was the heavy weight of the backing structure.
So the GBT actually took longer, I think, than the 140 foot. Ten years.
I guess that's right. What do you think the 140 foot was? 8?
Something
57
like that.
65?
Yeah. Yeah, it was sort of in the background. It didn't have anywhere near the potential impact that you described last week about the 140 foot almost bringing NRAO down.
Yeah.
The in your talk at the 50-year symposium, you mentioned that there was a wide range of proposals, bids for 140 foot.
Yeah, there sure were.
And with hindsight, you said that should have been a indication.
That's correct. It certainly should have. Mm-hmm.
But didn't the same thing happen with the GVT?
There were three proposals, and they spread in value, yeah.
But not to the extent, I think, that the 140 did.
Well, I don't know what the 140 was. Well, there was a factor of 1.5.
Oh, no, nowhere near the same.
Between the lower and the higher.
Oh, okay. I thought there was over 100 million, which was the... Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to go back and check on that. Mm-hmm.
The spread in the 140 foot was huge. It was 2 million to 14 million.
Yeah, no.
And the latter turned out to be right.
Yeah.
Well,
more or less.
Yeah, that's not fair to say the 140 foot cost 14 million because a lot of the early money was wasted.
Right.
You know, had the thing been built directly, the proper cost would have been 7-8 million, something like that.
But the same is true to an extent with the GVT. As if you had to redo it again in 2003 or 2004, it would have been much less than 100 million. Because a lot of that was engineering that had to be.
I believe that to be true, yeah. There was a lot of outfitting work in the field that should have been done in the factory.
Somewhere I saw, I never heard this before, that the 300 foot proposal was turned down the first time.
It rings a bell. Yeah, but what, not by the NSF, but by our committee. And then Struve endorsed it.
Which committee? The visiting committee? Or?
Yeah, the visiting committee. I think the visiting committee. And Struve endorsed it. And they said, well, if Struve endorsed it, it must be okay. And the visiting committee said it would be okay. So then we sent it to the NSF.
Okay. I'd never heard that before.
And the NSF approved it. That was a very fast approval.
Yeah, that's what I've always heard, so it was probably...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You mentioned that Bob Hall worked on the design between jobs.
Yeah.
Which jobs?
Blomnox and Rohr.
Rohr, mm-hmm. Right, okay. And it was as a result of that, did you recruit Bob Hall for the GVT?
Way back, yeah, that's right, sure. Mm-hmm. Bob Hall also did the 85s.
Yeah. And what about the 36 foot?
He did the 36
foot. Well, he was at Rohr.
At Rohr. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. That finishes. Anything on those things? All right, let's go to millimeter astronomy.
All right.
I think Frank Drake was the one that was pushing millimeter astronomy.
That's right.
Yeah, don't shake your head. You guys.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Otherwise, you have to write that.
Okay.
Planetary studies.
What?
For planetary studies.
Ah.
I don't know.
That would make sense.
He was certainly big in planets.
Yes.
And he did the Venus thing.
Yes. I suppose so, but I don't recall that coming up in the discussions as to what it was going to be for particularly, although I would have had to.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't remember one way or the other. That would make sense, though.
And he's the one that recruited
Frank Lowe. Yes, he is.
How did he know about Frank Lowe?
Lowe had a bolometer that Drake was going to use for millimeter waves. Now, how Drake knew that, I don't know. But Lowe was at Texas Instruments at the time.
Right. So the whole 36 foot was designed around
Lowe's bolometer, I think.
The focal ratio,
yeah,
that's
right.
Correct.
And then he left just about the time it was
he
finished.
He left before it was finished, actually. Mm-hmm.
Do you know why?
Well, his real interest was infrared, I think. And he wanted to develop an infrared lab in Green Bank, and he did to some extent, but I wasn't real keen on it. So he, when he got the opportunity to leave, he went there and to develop infrared.
It's not a coincidence that the 36 foot and Frank ended up in Tucson together. That site was chosen for the 36 foot, and he was out there before he left the observatory.
Why did we choose Tucson? You know, I don't remember why. I think probably it had to do with the fact that Kitt Peak was there.
So you didn't have to do infrastructure.
Yeah. And I think Frank Lowe thought that that was a good place for it as well. And he wanted us to go to, what's the other mountain? Graham. Graham.
Lemon. Yeah.
That's where he had a lot of his other stuff.
That's
later.
Right.
Well, yeah, later.
Mm-hmm. But there was stuff up there already.
Yes.
With, what's his name? Who was the guy at Arizona?
Before Street Matter.
No. Infrared guy. Yeah, before Street Matter, too. Mm-hmm.
But Lowe was in residence in Green Bank.
Yes, he was.
Came. And then he went out to Tucson because of the 36 foot as an NRO. Still as an NRO.
No, I don't think so.
I see.
I think he quit.
I see.
Before that and went to Arizona.
Because he had left by the time I came.
You never did see his King Midget then. That was a great car.
Oh.
You what?
Ken never did see Frank's
electric
King
car?
No, this little King Midget car.
Wasn't that electric?
I think I did out there.
Yeah.
Well, out in Arizona.
I think I remember taking me home to dinner once.
It had a lawnmower motor in it.
Misremembering. But he was a big Corvette fan, and he probably took you home in his Corvette.
Yeah, no, that's what I remember. Yeah, it was a sports car, yeah.
Yeah.
Frank Drake, you mentioned last time you and John Finley were the first two scientific staff. When did Frank Drake come along, or did you hire him, or?
Yeah, I hired him, but I can't tell you exactly when.
Yeah.
In the 50s, late 50s, but he and...
Menon.
And you.
Yeah.
And Sandy. But no, you said Sandy came in 65,
later.
But as a student he came there in about 1960 or 61. Sandy did,
right.
Yeah. So Drake came. Drake was there when Struve was there, so...
When I came as a student in 1959.
He would have been there.
Wade was there.
Yeah.
Drake was there.
Yeah. Menon?
Can't remember when Menon, but that era.
Yeah.
I had occasion to ask Coach Hugh, and he wrote the first observatory publication.
Did he?
On Orion Nebula.
Menon.
Okay.
Menon.
Yeah, I remember that.
I was interested in the question whether those were refereed papers.
They were not refereed. That was Struve's baby. The NRAO was supposed to have...
That was normal at the time.
It was a syllogism in Struve's mind, right?
That's
all
right.
All great observatories have their own
That's right.
publications.
That's right. That's right.
NRAO is a great observatory, therefore.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Well, let me say, it wasn't unusual.
That's correct.
And Caltech had it also.
Oh, well, they all did. McDonald, Yerkes, California, several observatories in California.
Well, now wait a minute. Caltech, for example, simply republished things that were published in APJ and places like that.
There are two series.
Were there?
Yeah, I have the honor of being the author of a few of the things that weren't published.
Okay.
There were the Yellow Jackets, which you're thinking of.
Yeah?
And that was called Observations of the Owens Valley Radio Observatory. And then there was also, with the same yellow covers, but red print instead of black print, and that was called Publications of the Owens Valley Radio Observatory. Okay. And and that was used for data, so my source spectra. You okay, Dave?
Yeah, I'm okay, for the time being anyway.
Source, flux densities and all that, to put in that private publication. Mm. So all those early people came from Harvard.
Well, they're the only ones I could get to come.
Drake?
They're not the only ones I asked.
Because there's Drake, Wade, Menon, Bill Howard, May Kasem, and John Campbell later.
That was pointed out to me by Fred Haddock and others. But I tried. I couldn't get others.
Could you name some others?
Sure. Ed McLean, Connie Mayer. Even, although I'm glad he never came, the guy who was in the Netherlands for so long.
Westerhout.
No.
Charles Seeger.
Seeger.
Oh. Yeah, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, I'm just as glad he didn't come, but you don't put that down. Ooh.
It's already there.
It's already there.
I think he's no longer with us.
Though. No.
You think that?
Yeah, a few years ago. Mm. His brother might be, though. Yeah.
Pete is?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Oh.
No. But at the time, there weren't many universities that had astronomy programs. So Haddock and others who might have criticized you were, there wasn't all that much opportunity.
That's right.
Harvard was the gold standard.
That's right. And they had a lot of opportunity to hire other guys. When they were hunting for a director of NRAO, when Struble was leaving, they asked everybody in the world before they asked me.
Yeah, no, I have record of that, yeah.
Including, I'm pretty sure, Haddock and McLean.
We have that somewhere. All those people. I get confused with the first time around. They also asked. Before Struve, they asked many people.
They probably did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Struve was on the committee.
Yes.
So also not an unusual. So Bart Block, did he get heavily involved? I mean, he was sort of, he thought of himself as a father of NRAO.
Yeah, but what
happened? Many others.
Yeah, but now my timing is going to be a little difficult here, but Bart Bock got into a big fuss at Harvard.
Right.
He thought he was going to be the next director when Howard Shapley left. And Shapley had told him so, according to Bock. So when Menzel was named director, Bock went off to Australia in a huff.
Right.
And that was in the midst of the NRAO stuff. So he was there for the beginning of the NRAO stuff, but not later.
No, but then when he came back.
When he came back, he was involved again. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he was one that was offered the first time around, while he was still at Harvard, but after he had agreed to go to Australia.
Is that right?
Yeah.
There were papers in my mother's archives, letters to Shapley, which led a person that wrote a PhD dissertation on my mother to believe that some of Bark's problems were that he supported Shapley at the time of the House of American Activities Committee hearings. And that stained Bach with the upper management. Now, I don't know. I think I asked you about this before, and you were certainly a little skeptical.
I don't know either.
I mean, Shapley was
you
in
mean
trouble.
That by supporting Shapley in that, he was at odds with the management at Harvard? Is
yeah,
that what you're
because
saying?
The Harvard people threw Shapley under the bus for a while with the House on American Activities Committee.
Yeah. I don't know, Dave. I don't know about that one at all.
I think Bob describes it more or less along the lines you just described in his oral history that you've seen.
It's the one from AIP.
Yeah, right. Let's go back to 140 foot. We talked last time about all the trouble in the construction, the delays and the cost, and in the end, I think you said explicitly that Burke had quit because of that, the 140 foot.
Was what?
That Lloyd Berkner.
Oh, quit.
Yeah.
Lloyd Berkner and Dick Emerson both quit over the fuss of the 140 foot, yes.
And Struve was a byproduct of that.
A byproduct?
Well, of the 140 foot, I mean.
What do you mean, in what
well,
sense?
Well, he left around the same time.
Oh, yeah. He left a little bit later.
Right. That's right, because Robbie was president. Oh, did you bring that list? We were talking last time about who was president between Berkner and Robbie, and you said it was a movie mogul. Was that?
Oh, sure.
Edward Reynolds.
No.
Well, it wasn't Lee Hayward.
No.
I didn't realize.
Keith Glennon.
Oh.
He was president.
That was later.
Okay, but he was president. He was the one that I was.
Right.
The movie mogul. It was him.
Wasn't he administrator of NASA also?
Yeah,
first,
he was
first,
of
yeah.
the first NASA, the Mercury program or something.
That's where I knew the names. I didn't have no anything to do with movies.
Yeah. He was a nice guy. He didn't get along at all with
director
the director at Brookhaven.
Yeah. Not Maurice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They didn't get along at all. I don't know why.
Was that still because Goldberger thought he should report directly? He said something about he felt he should report directly to the board and not to the president.
Well, that too, yeah. But that never came up when anybody else was president.
Oh, I see. Okay. No, he said it came up with Robbie. I thought you...
Came up when Keith Glennon was president.
Oh, okay.
Then at that point, Maurice Goldhaber wouldn't report to him. But that was it, yeah.
So those are bad times for NRAO. I mean, you said that last time. What in your mind saved NRAO, made it what it is now? Was it the success of the 140 foot?
Not the 140 foot.
Well, I would put the 300 foot ahead of the 140 foot.
I mean, the bad times were before the 140 foot was finished.
Yeah.
I thought, so how could the 140 foot save it?
It was finally finished.
Yeah, but by then, things were better.
Yeah, but still, the reputation was...
I think myself that it was the 300 foot, because the 300 foot established us as a visitor institution, and people came to the 300 foot, even though it wasn't the world's greatest telescope. We began to have a visitor program then and began to do the things that we were supposed to do.
Let's talk about the visitor program. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think up until that time, or up until NRAO, essentially all observatories, not just radio observatories, but all observatories existed almost exclusively for the staff of that organization.
Yes.
And it might have had a visitor from now and then or something.
Yes.
NRAO and Kit Peak came about sort of at the same time, but the Kit Peak goals were different from NRAO.
Maybe, I don't know.
The motivation there, I think, was to provide observing time for the have-nots. Whereas in NRAO, it was to provide unique first-class facilities that nobody else could afford.
Okay. Right? Yes, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
Dave Hogg is frowning.
Well, yeah, to zero order, that was right, but I'm not sure you could find that in any document that chartered these observatories. I think that was the difference in the management of the two observatories, was they defined these goals. The goals were as you described, but that was not why the observatories were set up. That was the implementation of setting the observatories up. They were both set up to provide facilities for university observers. Mm-hmm. Now, the optical observers have a somewhat different view because...
Well, different requirements, actually.
Because the big universities had their own observing facilities. So it did morph into a have-not thing for Kit Peak, whereas we were, well, there were university facilities, big ones, in radio astronomy, too.
Not 1956, and not during the early 50s when all the discussion occurred. Mm-hmm. It came later.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But I think the difference you describe is not in the charter documents, but in the implementation of the charter documents. Mm-hmm. That's why I was frowning.
Thank you. And I went a step further. The original motivation for the National Radio Observatory was to provide facilities for Americans to compete with Australians, UK, well, everybody.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah. I'm a little hesitant about the four Americans because from the beginning we always thought of it as being, or some of us did anyway, as being for everybody.
Yeah, well,
and nobody objected to that.
Well, that was what I was driving at. I think that was pretty unique. No, I'm pretty sure that, I mean, all those early discussions during the 50s, the motivation was that the U.S. was behind the rest of the world.
Yes, yes.
So who made it? What was an important decision about making it completely open based on merit? Does that set the stage for the...
I don't know.
What? Well, was it you?
It was probably me, but I think the AUI board had a lot to do with it. I was opposed to restrictive... I guess that's as good a way to say it as any, to restrictive things. I thought we should be just there for everybody. And this wasn't 100% popular using federal money all the time, and I can't remember the context in which it wasn't, but I do remember that for a while some people thought it wasn't. But it never came to be an issue. We had a lot of people from Europe, and nobody really complained about that I can recall. So
every once in a while, a National Science Foundation would ask specifically for the fraction of time that was being awarded to foreign-based observers. And I think there was this lingering concern that it not get to be too large a fraction.
Yes, and there was a lingering concern there wasn't any reciprocity at the time.
Wow, that was a source of a lot of bitterness.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit, I mean, it's a bit of an issue now. I mean, the fraction's about half, depending on which facility you're talking about.
Really? And some people are fussing that it's too big or something?
NSF.
Mm-hmm.
As Dave said, they keep asking questions. In Australia, I think it's 70% foreign use. And they take pride in that. They say, well, it shows what a great instrument we have.
And some of those are Americans, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, again, we've got the situation now that we wanted.
It's much better.
Yeah.
Not.
There are some places that it's difficult. It's difficult at Bonn, unless you're with somebody at Bonn.
And ERAM. ERAM is very specifically
installed. Okay.
They don't even pay lip service to it, at least
okay.
The FBI does. And there are those places that if you apply and say, oh, we were already planning to do that.
But I thought, maybe I'm wrong, I thought that our policy sort of opened the door for other people, maybe only in the context of, or mostly in the context of working with others, but nevertheless, it seems to me that there was more internationalism to observing later on as a result of the open door policy at NRAO.
Well, I believe
maybe that's
that
just
to
hopeful
be true.
Thinking. Huh?
But
yeah.
No, I believe that to be true because ultimately, the UK, certainly the Australians, all of us, the Dutch, to some extent. But ERAM has always been.
Well, that's in their charter. I mean, of course, ALMA's a bit uncertain now how that's going to work. But I think you're right, Dave. NRAO gets the credit for having led the in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
People have more or less taken it on. Going back to 140 foot. It was ultimately very successful, but why? It wasn't, I don't think it was as good an antenna as the Algonquin Park and 120 foot, which was an LTS mount. It wasn't as good as Haystack, which was only 120 feet, worked in the 1 centimeter quite well. But yet it was 140 foot that premier facility for at least 10 years.
Well, aren't there two possibilities? One is that we've had the good electronics.
Right.
And the other is we had this policy of letting people come in who
right.
were good people. And they did the right things, interesting things.
That's what I had written
and
down.
Haystack okay. had a small staff and they couldn't do a whole lot.
Do you remember the first really successful experiment on observation of 140 foot?
No, but it probably had to be Peter Metzger.
Right.
I presume you refer to recombination
yes.
line.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You want to comment on that? Or
no, what is there to comment? I was glad to see it happen.
In my mind, it was the first scientific publication, I think, and it brought the 140 foot to the attention of,
mm-hmm.
of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Were you at the 1964 Hamburg IAU?
Yes.
Do you remember Al Barrett chaired a session where there were the two Russian presentations on radio recombination lines?
Sort of, now that you mention it, yeah.
And he ridiculed them.
Who ridiculed them?
Barrett.
Oh.
Of course, they could barely speak English. The presentations were with an opaque projector where the signals to noise ratio was about 1.5. I mean, literally, the signal on the screen. So you could barely see it.
Yeah.
And
I do.
It was a poor presentation.
I do remember
and
that now.
Just,
I had forgotten it completely, but you bring it back, yes?
So you haven't gone back to look at that? Or
no, I have not.
Because, with hindsight, I think their stuff was okay.
Mm-hmm.
As was a number of other things that the Russians did
mm-hmm.
in those years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that recombination line business predates 1964. prediction.
Yeah. Now, this is the observational detection.
I understand. But the prediction was extant when I was in graduate school, because I was assigned a paper, a task to review that paper.
Which one?
I can't now remember.
Not Kardashev's. Because the first paper, and I can't remember, was it George Field?
I can't remember.
Yeah, the first paper said you couldn't see it because of star broadening. And it was Kardashev.
Doesn't later. Matter. But
yeah, it was Kardashev.
It was a Russian paper.
Oh, it was a Russian paper. Oh, it's Kardashev.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what the Russian people followed up on that. Mm-hmm. I think Vets could try this on the 85-1.
He may have. I don't remember.
You remember that.
The story is that he knew he would see it on the 140-foot.
So you mean he had a 2-to-1 signal noise on 85 foot or something?
Well, it was better than that.
Better than that. Mm-hmm. When? You remember how early that was? Or how
well,
much before?
It was approximate to his 140-foot time.
Yeah, oh, okay. Because I can't imagine Peter sitting on this for a year if he had it.
I don't think it was a year.
Yeah.
But I think, well, I don't want to put words in the system. But I think he went to 140 foot convinced that he would have a successful first paper for the 140 foot. I'll leave it at that.
Well, that's important, Dave, and that's sort of what I was driving at. Because I don't know where I've heard this, whether it's from you or Peter or. Now, the Brookhaven model for visitors was different, though, because their people built big instruments.
Yes.
And for a time, that happened a bit at NRAO, especially on 300 foot, I think.
Yeah, it's what the DTM guy wanted. I forget his name.
Burke.
No. Well, his boss.
The boss, but Burke was there with
a... Yes, Burke was there with his own equipment.
Yep.
But I can't remember.
Merle Tuve.
Merle Tuve, thank you. That's what Merle Tuve wanted. He wanted a 300 foot, and you drove up to it in a truck with full of stuff and
right.
plugged it in, and that was it. Mm-hmm. He didn't want anything else. And incidentally, the 300 foot, the Green Bank is in Green Bank in considerable part because of Merle Tuve, who wanted it to be within 300 miles of Washington.
We've heard the 20 mile story, but it was Tuve that was.
Mainly it was Tuve, I think, yeah. Tuve and Berkner didn't get along at all. And I think if Tuve was in favor of that, Berkner was probably opposed to it, but I don't know.
The iconic picture of the 300 foot in the snow with the shadow, some shadow on the snow, has Burke's correlated trailer in it.
I don't think they actually brought anything in, did they ever?
Oh yeah, no, they had a there was a
oh yes,
filter bank or
yes,
some
they
kind
did.
Of
they
multi,
did.
Multi-channel
that's
H1
right.
receiver.
That's right, they did.
The H1 processor,
yep,
the receiver
yep,
was ours.
Yep.
It was one of the serious pieces
I'm
of
serious
line
about
equipment.
That, yep.
When I came, NRL was doing a lot of this. Polarization.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Mayer, Sloanacre.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed, at least with 140 foot, I guess. The NRAO providing all the.
Oh, yeah. It got pretty complicated to provide right. your own equipment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't recall anybody. Well, some back ends. Somebody brought a back end for pulsar work once.
Mm-hmm. Huguenin?
Hmm?
Huguenin?
Maybe.
Taylor?
Maybe.
Well, not Taylor. That would be Hedy, but it would be quite late on.
Well, he was working with Huguenin at UMass.
He worked for Huguenin.
Well, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure that somebody had their own pulsar machine back end.
Yeah, well, that tradition has continued.
Has it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Very much so.
Arecibo also. Yeah.
Receivers generally from NRAO labs were the best.
Yeah.
So it was hard for a university to compete with those.
Yeah, yeah. People brought their own mixers to 36 foot.
Well, that's because Mill Labs had
something different, but they did, especially Penzias and Wilson.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Maybe only Penzias and Wilson.
Only, yeah, we had no technology to compete with theirs.
Let's go back to the VLA.
Mm-hmm.
The original proposal, or at least the original thinking, was pretty much for continuum instrument.
Mm-hmm.
When did the spectroscopic capability come in?
Gee, I don't remember.
Not so much when, but why?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't know. It was before the VLA was actually approved.
Was it in response to criticism about the lack of spectroscopic capability? Or?
There was a lot of criticism about the VLA, but I don't recall it being that.
Uh-huh. I would guess, I can't remember either, unhappily, but I would guess that the success of Caltech and Westermort, or in Holland, I should say.
Ah, there you go. That might be something,
provide something of an impetus to us.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, by the time we were completing early design, there had already been good success at Caltech, flying interferometer.
And the first?
It was Clark, right?
Yep.
It was.
Well, the last of many Owens Valley array proposals very heavily emphasized the spectrum. In fact, the only way they changed it was the spectroscopic capability.
I think that was to emphasize the merit of a big dish versus an 85 foot.
Clark, when he was ready to leave Caltech, sent me a letter saying he wanted to come to Green Bank. He had never done any continuum work. He'd like to do some.
He did. Well, certainly the VLVI.
Well, okay.
He did. He did it on the Green Bank interferometer.
Yeah, of course, that's right.
Okay.
A little bit.
Well, it was a big Clark and Hogg program. Filled all the cabinets on the whole Green Bank.
The ones you
didn't have. Well, half the cabinets.
The ones you didn't have.
The ones I couldn't get at, because they were. But the first VLA correlator was.
It
was just for continuum. It was a limited number of. Wasn't there a prototype? A correlator built for a limited number of antennas for just continuum work? No?
I can't remember.
I can't remember either, but I sort of doubt it. I think that by the time the VLA was actually built, Sandy would have had a...
I thought there was a throwaway correlator, but maybe I'm wrong.
We were running line, H1 line with Grayson on the Green Bank interferometer in 1970.
That's right.
So line interferometry was not unknown at NRAO, as well as, of course, by then, Westermort was full cry. So it would surprise me if that correlator didn't have some limited line capability.
That'll be easy to find out. Tell us about the NSF in the early years. A naive picture is you driving over to Washington, talk to somebody for half an hour about what you want to do, and they wrote you a check. That's an oversimplification,
that's
exaggeration, but one has the impression it was different from.
Well, it certainly was different. We dealt directly with Alan Waterman, who was the first director. And his deputy was Randy Robertson, and we dealt directly with those two guys.
Who's we, in particular?
Well, me and Jerry Tape, I guess. I don't know who else. Probably with
Ted?
Some.
Ted. Ted knew Randy Robertson very well.
Say what?
Ted knew Robertson very well.
Yeah.
That's Ted Reif we're talking about.
Ted Reif. And he would have known the business people in NSF. Ted would have. I can't remember their names. I lost my train of thought. Where were we?
Talking about working with the NSF. And
yeah, okay.
Randy
so
Robertson.
In the beginning, we worked directly with Randy Robertson and a guy by the name of Paul Shearer. And
I'm sorry, can you spell that?
S-H-E-A-R-E-R, I think. And I can't remember what his role was, what his position was in the NSF, but his role, as far as we were concerned, was he was the ombudsman for us. Because I can remember him taking me to the... what's the fancy club that everybody belongs to?
Cosmos
Club for lunch and dinner and talking about strategy to get things done at the NSF and hang in there, Dave, and so on and so forth. And so he was a big help, but I don't remember his official position, except it was high up. He had the ear of Waterman and Randy Robertson. And then... but then as the NSF grew, we kept getting pushed further and further down the line until we saw the director only during our annual review with the NSF. He would come in and sit at a table and listen to us talk, and all the people like Jim Wright who came in and listened, they all took extensive notes to show that they were paying attention.
At what level were the decisions made?
Oh. Well, it depended, of course, on the nature of the decision. So I can't really answer.
The budget?
The budget, well, again, I don't know how far that went. We would... towards the end of my stay, we were dealing strictly with the astronomy division. Well, the National Center's part of the astronomy division. And there was a guy there, he was an assistant director to the NSF. His name escapes me at the moment. He was a former admiral.
Owen.
Tom Owen. And his former aide, his captain, was...
yeah, he was very influential.
He was influential.
Yeah.
Can't think of his name either.
Ted would remember.
What?
Ted would remember.
Ted would remember, yeah.
So Owen, what was Owen's position?
He was assistant director to the NSF until they reorganized things.
For MPS, I guess.
Or facilities.
No. We were in the other division.
AAEO.
Yeah.
Right.
And
okay.
He was the guy for MPS. Was a physicist. That,
Hughes?
No.
Later. Hughes was later.
But Hughes was for the AA, for the NRAO part. This guy was a physicist for the physical sciences, and
I
can't.
He was Hughes. Moved. I think he's told me he was responsible for
moving astronomy
into MPS.
Into MPS? Is that where it is now?
Yeah.
Oh.
Which, you know, paper makes sense.
Yeah, sure it does.
But
in hindsight, that may not have been
politically.
Yeah. What?
It may not have been a really good move for us.
For us.
Oh.
We got kind of dwarfed by the others.
Now, astronomy grants had been in MPS, right? I mean, before that, we didn't compete directly.
Yes, we did. Astronomy grant at some point, astronomy grants and the national centers were in the same group, the same thing. but I think not when Owens was there.
Yeah, right.
And so we didn't exactly compete, but in a sense we did compete because they looked at the total sum for each. And yeah. Isn't that right, Dave?
Yeah.
He knows more about this than I do anymore. For one thing, his brain is better than mine nowadays.
Just by about one epsilon, though.
When did you start participating in these activities?
1974. Yeah, I came back from Green Bank to be a assistant. And at that time, Tate was president. And he talked to the director of the NSF and the director of MPS or whatever division we were in. And Dave talked to the division director and the astronomy chief. And I, once in a while, if I was a good boy, could talk to the astronomy chief. But mainly, I talked to the guy that had the NRO.
That sounds right. They became very, very bureaucratic.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the guy that I talked to, whose name will come back to me after a while, got an award, a meritorious award, for the NSF for long service.
Really?
Yes. Oh.
Well, there was the guy.
Remember, you were on tape.
For a while, there was that guy from RPI.
Oh, Bob Robert
Fleischer.
Fleischer.
He was the first.
He might have been the first, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was way before then.
Yep.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm.
I inherited his house when I moved to Green Bank as a student. He was in the Lofar.
Well, for a summer, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During the VLA construction, the NSF sent somebody here to Charlottesville to monitor the contract or something. We threw him out after a while.
We threw him out?
I suspect there was a little poetic license going on here. They did have a guy posted to Socorro.
Yes, they did.
Oh, Socorro.
And that guy got a... along with Jack Lancaster, he got an award of recognition for his great service in doing
the VLA. Oh, he did?
Yes, he did.
Is that the one you referred
to?
No.
That guy reported to the one I referred to. But they had a special person.
That's right, they did. Uh-huh.
And he may have briefly been here. I can't remember that. Hmm. But most of his time he was in. It was the NSF was understandably uptight about the VLA. It was their biggest non-mohole project. as people often reminded them.
Yeah, well, one distorts their memory over the years, but I thought I remember that you wouldn't let them use NRO pencils or office.
I don't remember anything like that. No.
Maybe that's my imagination.
No. And Lancaster had the ability to get along with these guys very well.
Yeah.
And, maybe his experience at Brookhaven, where they had close supervision all the time from him.
That was the Department of Energy.
Yeah.
But it was a style that was much more
like
what happened with the VLA construction.
Yes.
Than prior to that at NRAO.
Yeah.
The NSF would have auditors. The auditors were always.
But I don't think we ever really objected to that, because that was not an unreasonable thing, huh?
No. Having the guy in Socorro?
Yeah.
And it gave more rapid approval. So if Jack needed to buy something, a bunch of railroad ties or something.
Putting somebody out there with Lancaster was a guarantee that Lancaster would subvert him to... to be a fan of the VLA and NRAO.
I guess it worked. Where did John Finley fit into all this? You mentioned in the beginning you and he had complementary roles in science and electronics. I think when I came shortly after that, he was
site. First, he'd gone to Arecibo for a year, then he was site director at Green Bank. Then you had some disagreements, I think.
Lots and lots of them. Was he ever site director at Green Bank?
Mm-hmm. For a year, yeah. His big accomplishment was building the swimming pool.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether he was site director twice. Because I thought when he came back from Arecibo, he was site director, but I'm not sure about what he went to Arecibo. I can't. I would have to look that up. But yeah, he was definitely site director.
Okay.
I
don't know how much you want to say on the...
Oh, go ahead.
I think John was a sad case. He was, in the beginning, he was extremely helpful and good about everything. But he began to have all kinds of problems, and it was partly drinking and it was partly his diabetes, I think, which don't go together. And so eventually he became impossible.
Right.
And
he didn't, I think.
But he was hired originally by Lloyd Berkner, who had known him in Europe for some activity that John had been involved in. And Berkner was impressed by him. And he came early on, and as Dave said, he was in charge of electronics, and I did astronomy at Green Bank. And then Struve appointed me deputy director, and this infuriated Findlay. Not that being deputy director meant anything, but Findlay told Struve that he thought he, Findlay, ought to be deputy director, and so Findlay made him deputy director.
Sorry.
Huh?
Findlay made?
Struve made Findlay deputy director.
Also, or instead?
Instead. He told Findlay he was going to, I guess that's the story. He told Findlay he was going to make me deputy director. And Findlay objected so strenuously that Struve made Findlay deputy director. So Findlay was deputy director for a long, long time, even after Struve left. Because I didn't have the nerve to fire him as deputy director.
Well, you couldn't. He outranked you.
Sure. I didn't. I was director then.
Oh, weren't you a director? Sorry, yeah.
I couldn't in the beginning, but in the beginning I didn't. In the beginning I didn't want to either because Findlay was doing fine. I don't know. I don't know what happened to Findlay. He just his drinking and his diabetes just got away from him, I think.
So you inherited him, but he was deputy director while you were.
Well, I was head of the astronomy department or something like that.
So he did outright.
Yes, he did.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then you became.
I became director. Which infuriated Findlay.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah. He went to see Robbie. Robbie never forgave him for that. Robbie had no use for Findlay at all, which didn't help matters.
I think I recall him talking about Robbie, and he got along with Robbie much worse than you did.
Yeah.
But you kept him on as deputy director.
I kept him on.
As deputy director.
Yes. I was afraid not to, I guess. I don't know. It was a weakness on my part. Because he was no good as a deputy director. Maybe he was okay for a while. And then we started the VLA and we started the what did we call it? The LFST.
Yeah. Right.
And so Findlay and Von Horner did the LSFT. LFST. And Payne and Sandy did the VLA, you and I.
Findlay also did 36 foot, did he?
Yeah, he did the 36 foot.
Well, he was involved in that, but
in the 12
year. Payne had to finish it.
He had what?
Payne, that's right. Findlay left the 36 foot to go to Arecibo.
That's right.
And Payne
took it over then.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's right.
That's how it happened. And then when John wanted back from Arecibo, I think that's when he went to Green Bank.
But then he was in charge of the 12-meter upgrade or whatever it was called.
Probably.
Yeah, I think so. It was John
Payne. That's the middle 80s.
Yeah.
Mm. That could be.
Because he was a metrologist, and he developed a way to set the precision surface. And he and John had these elegant tools for doing that. He and John, of course, were joined at the hip. John Finley and John Fain were joined at the hip.
Yeah, they were very close. Finley had the ability to be close to some really competent people, and Payne was one of them.
Well, Finley was a very gifted person.
Yes, he was.
It's just he had,
yes,
had his problem. Mm-hmm.
Now, for a long time, particularly during the VLA construction, you and Hayne almost alternated weeks out there, or going out every third week?
I went out frequently, and Hayne went out frequently, and that's about all I can say about it, yeah. My going out was strictly for the fun of it, actually.
I still do that.
I just went out mainly to see how things were going on, and I would talk to Barry, standing up because he never gave me a place to sit in his office. That was his way of keeping the conversation short, I think. And I talked to everybody else. And
that's still fun to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I try once every year or two to get out to the site also, just because it's fun, but you know, there's no reason to anymore. There's no reason even to go to Socorro.
No. No.
Except to talk to people. But now
you got that kind of thing.
I sat here for a few hours. But during that time, Bill Howard kind of took over a lot of responsibilities.
What time are you speaking about?
Early VLA construction times.
Well, I'm bad on dates. Well, Bill was director at Green Bank for a while. Bill was a very, very good assistant to the director. But he wasn't all that great at doing things himself. His first action when he went to Green Bank as division head, or whatever the title was there, was to raise the price of coffee from a nickel to a dime, which Bennett became 11 cents.
Everybody remembers that.
No, the sequence was that Bill was an assistant to the director in the late 60s, until 1974.
Okay.
And during that time, he was resident in Charlottesville. I don't remember him having very much to do with the VLA.
No,
he didn't.
He did scheduling, he did body counts, he did for users.
The scheduling, that was very important. Because
I'm not saying it to denigrate him, I'm just saying what he did.
Yeah.
Now, in 1974, I came back, and he went out.
Green Bank.
And he left Green Bank 2-3 years later and went directly from Green Bank to the NSF.
Yes.
At which point he became the astronomy head.
Yes.
But at no time, in my memory, did he have any serious involvement with the VLA.
No, I wasn't suggesting that.
Okay.
My point was that you were preoccupied. You were spending a lot of time with the VLA.
Bill was very...
As was everybody else. And
yeah. Bill was very, very good at details. And he could, for example, write the budget for us and do things like that very, very well. And so he was, as far as I was concerned, he was an expert as an assistant to the director. So was Dave.
But Dave had a higher title. You took over from Bill as associate director for operations or something like that.
And did we reorganize it along there? Maybe so.
When did they start going out to referees?
What?
For observing.
Oh, boy, I don't know. Do you know?
Well, certainly before I was involved in 1974, so I think it was more like... Well, in fact, when I scheduled the Green Bank Interferometer, we had refereeing reports. So it was in the late 60s.
Okay.
You had referees for the Interferometer?
I don't remember at all.
Yes, we
did. I can believe that we had them pretty early, though.
Yeah, no, we had them for the interferometer.
Yeah.
But I remember putting the reports.
But it was Bill, the interferometer was done separately because you did
I scheduled that.
But the 140-foot and 300-foot.
Bill did. And the 36-foot.
And the 36-foot.
Yes.
So you did the 36-foot for a while, though.
When I was out at Greenville, when I was out to director it.
Because of these letters, there are these letters.
Well, when it was coming up online, Dave personally arranged, because
I remember the Penzias and Wilson stuff.
Yeah, well, that's a famous letter.
Right.
That you wrote to Penzias saying you're sorry, you can only give him a couple of months of observing time this fall.
Famous letter.
Well, it was posted for years on the wall of the 36-foot
really?
12-meter. Well, yeah, because
the
12 meters.
The archives.
12 meters had this myriad of observers, each of whom were arguing for 15 hours of observing time.
Yeah.
And some wit thought it would be useful to say how it was in the glory days.
And the first thing an observer did at the 36-foot, when he got there, was to look to see what the guy before him did.
Yep.
And the guy before him sometimes fudged the log.
Absolutely, he did. Oh,
I think there's only one such guy, though, who actually fudged the log.
The others,
Lou Snyder.
The others took great care about disguising. They would have strange names for sources.
It was Phil Sullivan, I think.
Phil.
Well, I'm not sure your statement that there is only one.
Okay, that's true. But I do remember coming to you and talking to you. You didn't do anything about it. And I thought, you know, you should be blacklisted. I mean, it became widely known. I thought you should be blacklisted. And you said something to the effect that there's a higher judgment.
I don't know. What could you do about it?
Well, not let a telescope. Obviously, that would have been
bothered.
But you're right about the higher judgment. Yeah, let's talk about Caltech some more. Especially those very early years. What was it? Really? Even before the VLA issues came up. What was the relationship with first John Bolton and Gordon Stanley? I heard a little bit on the other side.
Well, Bolton, I thought Bolton was a rather abrasive person.
That's an understatement. But
but as far as I know, we got along okay. I don't recall anything special with John.
He was on the visiting committee for a short time before he went back to
Australia. And he wasn't a bad visiting committee member.
Constructive.
Yeah. I had more trouble, actually, with Jesse and Martin Schmidt at the Dickey Committee hearings, which I guess was later than what you're talking about now.
What was Martin Schmidt's problem?
Well, they wanted the Caltech thing and not the VLA. And so for the Dickey Committee hearings, they sent Schmidt and Greenstein, two well-known radio astronomers, to support the Caltech thing. And Bolton was gone by that time, and Gordon Stanley was there, and he didn't have anything like the clout or the charisma or anything else that Bolton had. And he was a nice guy, and he was pushing... He was pushing the Caltech array, as were Jesse and Martin Schmidt. And Martin Schmidt said, "Oh, what's so important about 10 centimeters?" I was chiding them that they could only get a certain resolution in Owens Valley, which in the long run killed them, I think. But
what about Gordon? Again, going back to the 1960, 61, before the VLA, well before the VLA, Gordon replaced John on the visiting committee.
Mm-hmm.
Was he constructive or?
I don't remember very well, but I don't remember having any antagonistic feelings towards him. So I guess he was.
Okay.
Didn't he give us crystals?
That sounds familiar.
He was making crystals.
That sounds familiar.
No.
Yeah.
We were using commercial 1M34 diodes for mixer. You talking about mixer?
No, I'm talking about front end crystal.
Yeah. For mixer.
Yeah. It's okay. Right. Mixer crystal. Yeah. You were using what?
He may have given the mixer assembly, not the crystal. Because we were using commercial, not the commercial.
Well, I thought he made the crystals. He was giving us the assembly, yes.
That was his special thing. The thing that you put the mixer in.
Right.
Had the yellow.
Yeah.
Going in one end.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was his.
Because before that, there was a commercial one that we bought.
It was the mixer assembly that you
That's right.
from
him. Yeah. Yeah. The commercial one I gave, when I went to Jodrell Bank for 4 months, I took one with me. I had trouble getting it through customs, but we gave it to, or sold it to Henry Brown.
When was that?
50.
I didn't know you were at Jodrell Bank for 4 months.
I was at Jodrell for 4 months in 50. Oh, boy. Anyway, in the late 50s, sometime.
I just remembered.
Or maybe it was the early 60s.
Yes.
Maybe it was the early 60s.
I'm just remembering. I spent the spring of 62 at Cambridge working on my thesis.
Yeah.
And that summer, there was a summer school at John O'Bank.
Oh, yeah. I taught at that.
Yeah, right. That's right. First time.
But I wasn't at Jodrell Bank at
that
point.
That wasn't the
time that I was there before that, okay. I remember that summer school. I think there's a picture of all the guys somewhere.
There's a book.
Okay.
The front piece of the book. Mm-hmm. Speaking of pictures, there's also a picture of the famous 1961 meeting with the Russians in Green Bank.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Struve.
Of course.
Struve wanted to do that, and I don't remember now how we picked the people or how they picked the people.
Well, they must have.
Yeah.
That was organized through the academies?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a joint thing,
yeah.
The two different academies, and I think the Russian Academy is the one that chose the people to come from Russia.
Oh, that could be. That could well be. Mm-hmm.
I think I've seen a report or something written up by Frank Drake.
Yes.
Yes, he did. He wrote it up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. To summarize, what was the best thing you did during your years as director? The thing that had the biggest impact?
Well, I don't know whether this is true or not, but to me, I think it's the establishment of the concept of the National Observatory and the free use of the telescopes by people. That, I think, is, to me, the thing. But how much I had to do with that is something else. And I don't know that. But that's, I think, was a really good thing that came out of it, and it's something which is persisting, to this day. Everybody uses everybody else's telescopes in one way or another. And
just to clarify, I think everybody would agree with what you just said about open skies and the impact of that. But you said the concept of the National Observatory.
My concept of a national.
How the National Observatory, because the National Observatory concept came from others earlier.
A National Observatory concept came from elsewhere.
But
Kitt Peake's concept was different from ours, for example, for a long time. It might not be anymore.
Elaborate on that.
Well, they had far less freedom for the visitors. For example, I had the brilliant idea that the center of M87 would be polarized, And so I submitted a proposal.
Optical.
Optical. So use the 84 or 86 or whatever it is. And they said, gee, this looks interesting, but is it possible? So what's his name, Tom Kinman, went out the night to check it out. And he did it. And he decided it was possible. Then they let me come out. And we've got back-to-back papers in the APJ, which I think is disgraceful.
I think it was well known that NOAO or Kitt Peak staff had the same monthly allocations of observing time.
That's right.
It's traditional in optical.
That's right, yeah.
We had a fight for it.
That's right.
Burbage changed that.
Yes.
Did he? Good for him.
Well, he had been on our committees. Mm-hmm. And he thought this was a more enlightened way of doing business. But, of course, it cost him dearly in terms of staff support as director.
Well, even board support.
Yes. I was on their visiting committee when Burbage was director. And he didn't have the support at all from anywhere.
I forgot to ask about him, because I always thought of him as a friend and support, strong friend and supporter of NRAO.
Yeah, I think he was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He, for example, at the Greenstein, was it the Greenstein committee?
He was on the committee of
The Greenstein committee had their final meeting out west somewhere, I forget where, and they were going to finalize their recommendations. And Jesse was pretty much against the VLA being the number one recommendation. And I didn't go to that meeting. I was on the committee, but I didn't go to that meeting. And Burbage was instrumental in talking Greenstein into accepting the VLA as the number one priority. He had help from Burke, who was there, and probably somebody else as well, maybe Westerhout, I don't know. But Greenstein was, at one point, according to Burbage, Greenstein was ready to resign rather than do that. Well, Greenstein had a thing about national observatories. He didn't think they were useful or anything else, I guess, and in many ways. Although we became friends eventually, and he was okay.
You know, the 4 years I was there as a graduate student, I had no idea, A, about his early involvement with Reber and his background. He even seemed to pose, the astronomers were upstairs and the radio astronomers were on the first floor, and he even hardly had anything to do with the radio astronomers mm-hmm. there, even mm-hmm. his, you know, his department head.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Burbage, there was pressure from time to time, or suggestions at least, about we should have theoreticians on the staff at NRAO.
Yeah, and we tried that for a while.
With?
But they all turned into observers.
Right.
Bob Gelming started out as a theoretician.
Sebastian.
He remained one, pretty much.
Bob
Brown started out as a theoretician.
Well, Sebastian. He didn't become an observer, but he tried to design radio telescopes.
Yeah.
He became an engineer.
Yep. But we did want to have a theoretician on the staff, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had a visiting program.
A what?
A visiting program.
Yes, we did.
So I had Edward Harrison from Faulkner. Faulkner? Was it Faulkner? A guy from, was it Berkeley or?
Santa Cruz.
And then we had Dave DeYoung.
Right.
Yeah. He was actually on the staff.
Yeah.
We had Franz Kahn. That's when Struve was still here. Franz Kahn was walking across the field one day between the observatory office in his house, which was, he went to the cemetery and then went out that road, and he said all of a sudden a bolt of lightning came down somewhere, and he had been thinking bad thoughts about Oort.
How did Sebastian get to NREO?
Struve invited him as a visitor.
Struve knew of him or knew him?
Yeah, I don't know how actually, but he did. And then then Von Horner went back to Heidelberg, and I was over there for some reason, and I wanted him to come back to Green Bank, and I stopped and talked to him and offered him a job, and he came back to Green Bank.
Sebastian and a guy called St. Thomas Vary, who went to...
Who?
St. Thomas Vary, who went to Albany, SUNY Albany, and a third guy, each wrote very influential prize papers on star formation and gas dynamics, and they bundled it into a book. And I would not be surprised if that's not how Struve came to know it.
That could be.
It was a very important little
I've never seen that book, I don't think.
I've got it upstairs, but I'm not sure.
Probably, yeah.
And this guy, St. Thomas Vary, was cut from the same cloth as Sebastian. Really bright guy.
Yeah, I've met him. After they went there.
Yeah.
Did you know Doris Wilsdorf?
Don't know the name, no.
You don't know Wilsdorf Hall here in... Doris Wilsdorf was a physicist. Her husband was a physicist. They were both at UVA. She was a student of von Weizsäcker with von Horner.
Oh, okay.
She had a student, a guy by the name of Don Olson, who made tons of money, and they dedicated a physics building to Doris. And then he went and bought himself a ride on the German, on the Russian satellite, and took her over to watch the launch. She died recently, but she was a nice lady.
Do you know much about the Sebastian's relationship and recruiting? To go back to Bonn, to go back to Germany, to become one of the MPI directors.
Sebastian?
Yeah, this is the mid-60s.
No, I didn't know that at all.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait a minute. The MPI started in the mid-60s.
Yep.
Okay, so he might have been asked to be one of the original directors. I don't know.
But he and Hockenberg... out or something. Okay. That's why I asked. I don't know.
So he might have been asked before Peter?
Oh, well, yeah, well before.
Oh. But Peter was there at the beginning of the MPI.
Well, that was after the telescope was under construction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, this was before.
But there wasn't any MPI then?
Well, there was a Max Planck shell shaft. They didn't have the radio.
There was a gazelle shaft, sure.
But I think that's when they were talking about. Well, that's why I asked. I'm not sure.
Okay.
They were talking
to Sebastian
about building a radio telescope.
Well, no. Yeah. Hockenberg got the money for that from somewhere other than the gazelle shaft.
It was the Volkswagen.
Yeah. So the telescope, as you say, was already underway, and then it was incorporated into the gazelle shaft.
Yeah, it started at the University of Bonn, that's right.
That's right.
But there was some discussion, because I know Sebastian wanted a Tübingen. That was the reason he had...
He wanted what?
He wanted a telescope to be built in Tübingen, because that's where he wanted to live.
Oh, in Tübingen.
and that's why... Okay, if you don't know about it... It's,
okay.
All right, anyway, so you said what you thought was the best thing you did as director. If you had to do
the
it
worst.
All over again, yeah, what would you do differently?
Ken, these are hard questions.
Yeah, of course. Anything you regret?
I better come up with something, hadn't I?
I mean, aside from hiring...
Maybe you had no regrets.
Yeah, I mean, aside from hiring me or...
What would I do differently? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. What should I have done differently, Dave?
What should NREO, to be more gentle, what should NREO have done differently, if anything?
Well, I think that the main arc was about as good as you could do. That is, it was established as a national observatory. It did have the open skies. it built one of the premier astronomical telescopes in the latter half of the 20th century. So, you know, on the seventh day, maybe you need the day off, right? There are certain bumps along the road. I mean,
yeah, sure. There are probably a lot of little things I would have done differently, but I can't remember them now.
Dave, you almost answered the last question. So right at the height of all this, all the success of the VLA, which you've been working on for 10 or more years to get funded and get started and everything, and it's finally under construction, you stepped down as director.
Yeah.
Comment why? Right at the height of everything.
Well, there wasn't anything left for me to do other than bureaucracy.
That's what Dave just
implied. At least I didn't think there was anything. I couldn't imagine myself getting involved anymore in some major new project. And the bureaucracy, the observatory was 350 people or something like that, and it was a big bureaucracy, and I wasn't having fun anymore. So what was the point of staying on?
Dealing with the NSF getting harder?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was getting harder or not. It was fun when you talked directly to Alan Waterman. He was a nice guy, and Randy Robertson was a nice guy. But later on, you know, Bob, well, later on it was less fun.
Later on it was Bill Howard.
Well, yeah, it was Bill Howard. I can't comment about these things. Bill Howard was... He was okay as at the NSF. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can I
get a copy of that? Sure. Well, that's all I have. Covered a lot of territory.
Okay.
Dave? Ellen?